Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Karen G. Ruffel. She is Associate Professor at the University of Toronto's Mississauga campus. We will be speaking about her brand new publication, Everyday Shiism in South Asia. Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Raj. I'm pleased to be here today.
Yeah, I have a fellow Torontonian on the call. That's a rarity.
Yeah. Wonderful.
So tell us how this book project emerged. How did you end up writing on this topic?
So this project, sort of a number of years in sort of in the making, it developed in 2015, actually, when I was in India. I was in Hyderabad doing field work on a project that I had initially sort of in its earliest stages, for a number of years, sort of termed somatic Shiism, the body in Deccani Shi ritual and practice, and it's sort of morphed into something quite different than I'd be happy to talk about briefly later in the podcast, because it's the subject of my current book project. But I was approached by Rebecca Harkin, who is the acquisitions editor for religion and theology at Wiley. And she asked if I was interested in writing a book on lived Islam, sort of broadly conceived for their lived religion series, which they were in the process of sort of kickstarting back up. Joyce Flukiger wrote the Everyday Hinduism book for that series, and they wanted a book on Islam. And so I thought about it, and I thought, well, there are a lot of sort of books that engage with Islam. Islam is sort of a lived tradition in different ways. And I didn't really want to do another one of those books. And I thought about what I do, and that's Shiism, and what else I do. I'm a South Asianist. I don't really conceive of myself as an Islamicist. That's not what I do. I'm a South Asianist who specializes in Shiism. And so I countered, and I said, well, here's what I think the field really needs. And that's, here's a project that I would love to do. I would love to contribute a book focusing on sort of Shiism as a lived tradition in South Asia, and focusing on the everyday, which was, a key sort of aspect of my first book, Everyday Shiism. Or gender sainthood and everyday practice in South Asian Shiism. And so Rebecca really liked the idea. And so this project developed out of those conversations that I had with her. But then I just kind of sat on it for a couple of years, because I wrote the proposal, and it went through peer review, and I was given a contract in 2016, and then I just kind of felt a bit stumped. I wasn't sure where I wanted to go with it based on the chapters that I had proposed. And I had a separate chapter on gender and the life cycle. I knew I wanted to have material practice and architecture as central. I knew literature would be important, but I felt that something wasn't quite right about how I'd sort of structured the book. And I knew because it had to sort of be appealing to a broad audience. I also felt really stumped in terms of, and I know that some of this will sort of engage with some of the questions that you ask later, but I was also really sort of stumped in terms of audience. How do I write for both a scholarly academic audience and then perhaps a broader audience? And it was also my second book. And second books are actually a bit more difficult than writing the very highly structured first book, which emerges out of a dissertation. And that's often, you know, a slower process than the first book. And so it took me a bit of time to sort of conceptualize how I wanted this project to look, what actually the everyday sort of actually looked like for South Asian communities and individuals.
Yeah, there are a number of really interesting threads there. It's certainly, I imagine it would be much more work. So I published my dissertation and the second book, but the second book were the apocryphal chapters of my dissertation because I ended up writing essentially two dissertations unwittingly or enough for. And so it took a bit of work, but you know, there was a focus, there was a concept, but to start from scratch again with a research project. And so for the third book, I'm sort of spinning my wheels a bit. So I get it because I can go in a number of directions. And yeah, who knows where that'll go? We'll find out. Back to your book. Before we dive into, say, the data you're looking at, the methodology and those kinds of things, you said something really interesting in passing that really pertains to the rebranding of this podcast. And yeah. You said, you know, I'm a South Asianist. I'm not an Islamicist. And so you may be aware, but this podcast was called New Books in Hindu Studies for quite some time. And just earlier this year, it was rebranded to New Books in Indian Religions to make room for books such as yours, you know. And when you say that, what do you mean by that? Or why is that? Could you say more about that distinction for our audience?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important issue. You know, South Asia, potentially could be a political issue for some, particularly considering the climate in India, for example. India is not only a place where Hindus live. It's a place of tremendous religious complexity, and it's informed and shaped by multiple religious traditions. And so when I think about, I published an article last year in the journal Reorient titled Making Shiism an Indian Religion. And by Indian religion, I really mean a South Asian religion, a religion that's as much a part of the Indic as Hinduism or Sikhism or Christianity or Buddhism. It's part of this sort of broader sort of cultural and civilizational sort of complex. And so, you know, I come to define sort of this tradition, you know, the Shiism of the subcontinent as Indo-Shiism. And it's not Persianate, it's not Indo-Muslim, it's not Indo-Persian. I see the Shiism of this space as Indo-Shi'i. And so, you know, by that, I see it as sort of the blending of Indic, right? The expression of, you know, a basic South Asian identity, ethos, and worldview that is shared by Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and Buddhists and others who live and contribute right to these worldviews and identities and ethos and you know grammars of religion, right? And also a Shi'i Islamic religious sensibility, right? I see these blending together. And so for me, what I'm talking about in this book, a key word, right? A key term for me is Indo, that this is Indo-Shiism. And so to be a Shia, to be a Muslim in the subcontinent is to be participating in this broader sort of world of Indian religion.
Mm. It's a deeply syncretic soil. I mean, even the layers that we consider Hindu, you know, that umbrella term, at some point they were grafted to that soil, or they developed, or they were integrated into Brahmanism. And so we see parallel movements with Islam in India currently. When you say, for example, that there's a shared religious grammar or worldview, as you say, mm-hmm. Just to clarify, the Indo-Shia practitioners that you've engaged with, they would have a very different conception of time in terms of samsara, for example. Mm-hmm. Would they share this Indic worldview of reincarnation and cycles of time, or not?
So not everything needs to be shared, no. So in some regards, there are what I see as there are cyclical notions of time, but what is cyclical is very different. So if we look at, and this is something that I've actually thought about, and I've presented on it once, and then I've never kind of done anything else with it, but I think we can actually look at the ritual calendar, particularly with regard to Muharram. And so Muharram is, it's a month in the Hijri Muslim lunar calendar. It's the first month of that calendar, and it's also the month when the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, so the third Imam Hussein, he was martyred in Iraq in a place called Karbala. It was a place along the Euphrates River in the year 680. He and 72 supporters, many of whom were family members of his, were martyred by a political opponent, a caliph named Yazid. His army, which vastly outnumbered Hussein's small entourage, they were under siege and were martyred on the 10th day of this month of Muharram. And so this event is remembered each year. And so sort of the act of sort of cultural memory through which this, you know, Imam Hussein is sort of brought to life through sort of particular forms of material culture in which during those 10 days, Imam Hussein is sort of embodied and remembered and brought to life, and also through poetry, the recitation of poetry, and in sort of orations and in sort of assemblies called morning assemblies, the Majlis-e-Azah. These all sort of are cyclical in the sense that Imam Hussein and his family, called the Ahle Bayt, they're brought to life, and then that act of death takes place over and over and over again every year. And so in a sense, there is something cyclical about that. But in the sense of samsara, we don't, so for Muslims, there's really not that sense of sort of birth and, you know, and so death and rebirth coming back in, you know, in another form, you know, whether it's higher or lower forms. But I, you know, because there's always this movement forward toward you know, the day of resurrection and judgment and intercession, you know, by the, you know, by Fatima, by the imams, you know, on, you know, for the loyalty that one has to the Prophet Muhammad's family and to the imams.
What is the structure of the book? Maybe as you talk about the chapters, you can mention the data that you're looking at.
Yeah, so the book is, so again, so one of the challenges that I had in writing the book was thinking about the multiple audiences that I'm writing for. And so I wrote the book with, and so I'm also kind of anticipating and answering one of your other questions, because it also sort of gets to the chapters and how I've structured the chapters. I'm writing for multiple audiences. I'm writing for specialists and graduate students, people who are Islamic studies scholars, particularly Shiist studies scholars. Generally, when scholars, you know, write about Shiism and engage in Shiism, South Asia is often treated peripherally, if it's really engaged at all, unless somebody's actually writing about South Asia. And then it's often the focus is very, very sort of particularized, rather than sort of looking more holistically, which is what this book does. And in the chapters, as I sort of describe them, will give the listener a sense of what I mean by this. I'm also writing for a more general audience. So for undergraduates, this course, this book is ideal for undergraduate students and who are taking courses in, say, an Introduction to Islam course or an Anthropology of Islam course. Students who are in, say, a visual studies course or an art and architecture of South Asia course. So the book would be ideal for that. Students interested in gender also would have an interest in this book. Students who are interested in Hindu-Muslim encounter also would be interested in the book, particularly in the first chapter. English-speaking members of the South Asian Shi'i community, both in South Asia, so in India and Pakistan, as well as those living in diasporic contexts also would be interested in the book. So I've really tried to sort of pitch the book to speak across multiple levels. And so the writing is very accessible. So while I do engage with theory and use different theoretical models to help interpret the data that I present in the book, I also do this with what I hope is minimal jargon. So in terms of the chapters, I do have a fairly lengthy introduction in which I do provide sort of a sense of the field, particularly in South Asia. And I also help to sort of explain what I mean by everyday Shiism. And then I lay out what the everyday means through six different chapters. And the chapters, I start with a discussion of what I call sort of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. And this is sort of looking at non-Shi'i traditions of Alid devotion. And I present several case studies. I look at traditions of devotion of Husseini Brahmin communities. Then I examine Sufi inflected or Sufi oriented Muharram practices in village Deccan And so this is in South India, and this is sort of Muharram as it's practiced primarily in villages where there are no Shia. This would be how Sunni and Hindu communities come together to practice Muharram, and so Muharram ritual and sort of understanding of who Hussein and so Hussein and Hassan sort of come to be fused together, even though Hassan, Imam Hussein's older brother, the second Imam, was died about a decade before the Battle of Karbala ever happened. They sort of become fused together into these sort of fierce gods. So they get absorbed into this broader sort of Hindu pantheon of gods. And then I look at traditions of spirit possession around Qasim, who's sort of affectionately known as the bridegroom of Karbala. And he's also the subject of my first book. In the second chapter, I examine sort of traditions of Shi'i literary aesthetics. I particularly focus in this chapter on the Noha, which is a short poetic form that very interestingly has been understudied in scholarship. Scholars have tended to focus on the longer, sort of more epic Marsiya. And the Noha is really interesting because it's here that we see very much the female voice. We also see it in the Marsiya, but the female voice really comes to the forefront. It's much more emotional. It's written in a sort of more simplistic style, which is one reason why I think the Noha has tended to be sort of overlooked by scholars. And this is something that my doctoral student Nabil Jaffrey has observed in his master's thesis, that there's a sort of subgenre within the Noha that is sort of non-mourning. So there are Nohas. So there's a sort of large sort of range of poems of the Noha that focus on sort of ethical attunement, moral lessons, even sort of issues of, you know, sectarian issues. They're very strongly didactic, and they're really fascinating, and nobody's paid attention to them, and they're really, really fascinating. And there's also, I mean, not enough attention's paid to sort of the role of intertextuality in the Noha as well, which is something that you see across all of the sort of sub genres of the Noha. I also look at, within this chapter, the role of feminine voice and emotion. I also translate a miracle story, which again is an important space for women's religious practice and also women's spirituality. And these are actually remarkably, I think, complex stories. And so I translate and comment on one of these miracle stories called a Mujiza Kahani. And then at the end, I look at the role of fiction. And again, this is another space where non-Muslims and non-Shias have really participated and looked to the Karbala theme and Imam Hussein for sort of ethical lessons and sort of worked through particularly the trauma of partition in 1947 for sort of how to sort of transcend religious violence, but also to come together as a community of nations. And by nations, I mean religious nations. In the next chapter, I look at, and if I'm remembering correctly, either built space or, so the next chapter, I look at built space. And so in this chapter that I really start to bring in case studies, small case studies. And so I bring the reader to Hyderabad and to Lucknow, and I, in a sense, bring the reader on tours through buildings. We do close analyses of architectural formations and you know, what does, you know, what does micro architecture do? What does it tell? What does it convey to the viewer? What are, you know, how does a micro architectural form on a mosque that was once Shia in the 17th century that has become over time a Sunni mosque actually sort of help us to, you know, how does that, you know, sort of the form of micro architecture sort of translate to help us understand the Tazia, which is a replica, a Shebbi, of Imam Hussein's shrine tomb in Karbala. How does that help us to think about, you know, the portability of space, to help us to think about the role of creativity and the imagination, particularly for Shi'i communities that are living in sort of geographically distant from these shrine tombs and sort of centers of pilgrimage in Iraq, in Syria. And that's a theme that sort of is recurrent again and again and again in the book, that there's tremendous creativity that South Asian Shi'i communities have in making Imam Hussein and Karbala immediate, present, and real in the subcontinent. And so we see it in built space, we see it in sort of image objects such as the Tazia, these portable tombs. And so I take the reader to a mosque that has these micro architectural forms. And we think through the space. We think about, well, what happens when we start to really pay close attention to counting arches, to counting pillars, to counting, you know, different types of, you know, of forms? What happens when we pay attention to color? You know, can we now start, when we look, just walk by a space or we walk by a gate, can we now start to intuit that this might be a Shi'i space, when in the past we might have walked by and said, oh, it's just, you know, it looks really plain. How would I know that this is a Shi'i space? And so, you know, now I sort of help the reader to be able to understand wall paintings, to understand color symbolism, to understand the symbology of numbers, and a whole new sort of visual world opens up with regard to the real richness and creativity of, you know, the use of a built form. And so in the next chapter, with regard to material practice, I think, you know, about and present, well, what happens when we put ourselves with the objects that are in the built space. And it's, this is where, you know, with my current work, I was much more interested initially in the objects, the matter, the things. And I didn't care about the built space. And I became much more attentive and fascinated by the spaces that held things like an alam. And in Hyderabad, for example, it's the alam as sort of the devotional object or the image object that is sort of, you know, the Shi'i form of devotion par excellence. So we don't have tazias in Hyderabad, but we have alams. And these are metal standards or crests that represent or index Imam Hussein, his half-brother Abbas, Fatima, or other members, Hussein's son, Zain al-Abidin, who survived the Battle of Karbala because he was sick. He's known affectionately as Bimari Karbala, the sick one, the ill one of Karbala. And in Hyderabad, a city that is proliferates with relics, objects that are associated with the imams, with the Ahle Bayt, with the family. And it's a city that just, it's saturated with Shi'i relics. It's something that I find incredibly fascinating. And it's, so in this chapter, I write about these relics. And what's very interesting, in Hyderabad, we have alams that during the reign of one Qutb Shahi, with the Qutb Shahi dynasty, a Shi'i dynasty that reigned in the 16th and 17th centuries, a number of alams had these relics embedded in them. And so these are particularly sacred, holy, beloved alams. So they're what I've come to call in my research reliquary alams. And there are miraculous stories that get associated with the alam, with buildings associated with the alams. And so I tell some of these stories. So they become, again, case studies to help the reader to understand sort of the context in which these objects and spaces sort of are in symbiotic relationship and how communities develop around these objects. And so I do this for both Hyderabad and I do it for Lucknow as well. So I tell the story of a reliquary alam or that comes to Lucknow as well, to the Hazrat Abbas Dargah in Lucknow. And so for me, these stories are really important. And I talk about tazias. And so for that, you know, I discuss permanent tazia and ephemeral tazia. And so permanent tazias are big, they're heavy, they're carved of wood on which brass is overlaid, semi-precious stones. They're huge. They're very heavy. And ephemeral tazias are usually made by neighborhood associations. They're small. They can be carried. They're made of bamboo on bamboo frames covered with, you know, bright paper, cellophane, and they're relatively inexpensive. And so these may be purchased by families or neighborhood associations. And these are taken out on the 10th of Muharram on Ashura. And these are buried. They're cooled. So you do tanda karna to them. So they're cooled. And this process of ritual cooling releases Imam Hussein's body so that the next year he can return to inhabit this image object so that one can auspiciously gaze on the object, on the tazia. So one can offer prayers, one can seek his intercession to God, through God, okay? And so this is, it's a very complex and fascinating process by which, you know, these objects are actually very, very much agentival. They're endowed with agency. And they actually, as I see it, sort of subvert human subject agency. And this is where at the beginning of chapter four, I talk about Judith Bennett's sort of work with new material, her theorizing of new materialism. And I think that what this, you know, what the alam and tanzia's agency does is it sort of reverses, in a sense, the gaze, because through that act of gazing and asking for, you know, the intercession on behalf of God from the imam or a member of the Ahl al-Bayt who is inhabiting that image object. In a sense, you as, you know, the devotee, as the petitioner, is now the object, and the alam or taziyah becomes the subject. So it's something that I actually had to do a lot of thinking about in the process of doing this writing and thinking about what's actually happening. And then in the fifth chapter, which is the longest chapter in the book, is on Muharram. And so this in some ways makes sense. I would not say it was my favorite chapter to write, actually, which seems kind of weird. I enjoyed the build space and material culture chapters, I think, the most. But you know, because it was very much about the structure of the morning assembly of the Majlis e Azah. And so I felt it was in some ways very nuts and bolts. I had to make a lot of decisions about, I didn't want to include the events of of all 10 days. So I kind of had to make some of my own editorial choices about what I wanted to include, what days are most important. And then I had to make a lot of decisions with regard to poetry to include that in discourses, so majlis discourses, that I felt brought sort of the feelings, the sentiment of that particular day to life for the reader. And so that kind of, I sort of kept going back to particular days over and over and over again. I felt, you know, with some of the days, it just wasn't quite what I wanted. And some days I kind of kept just wanting to add more and more information and more poetry and more commentary. And I had to step back and I kind of had to shorten that. This was a chapter that was already so long and I had to shorten it considerably. I finish the chapter with a discussion of matam, which is self-flagellation, which is performed at different times during Muharram, but particularly on the 10th. And this is a ritual that I see as very much performed out of love and loyalty for Imam Hussein and his family. And it's not a transgressive act. I see it as socially affirming and intrinsically positive. And then this last chapter is about vow making, which again brings back women. I focus on the Dastur Khan, which is an explicitly women-only ritual, although often the vows that are made during and the meal is often held in honor of male members of the Ahl al-Bayt or imams. So that's kind of interesting, but even pregnant women are not allowed to participate in the Dastur Khan because they may be carrying a male fetus. So that I think is interesting. I also bring back I translate another miracle story, which is a kahani, which is called the Woodcutter's Tale. And then I talk about celebratory events, because I think that oftentimes when we think about Shiism, there is admittedly too much emphasis on Muharram and on mourning ritual, which is something I think that we need to, in the study of Shiism, we really do need to move away from that. And that's something, you know, even for myself, I'd like to do. And then the last, and there is a brief conclusion. And then for the last part of the book, there is an extensive teaching appendix. So because the book is also is, you know, for a broader reading audience for undergraduates, I would like for those who would like to teach the book to be able to think about how to use the book or how to think about South Asian Shiism sort of in concrete ways, not as an abstract phenomena. And so I make a number of suggestions. So I offer a number of suggestions for how chapters can be used in different types of courses. And then I also offer suggestions for documentary films. And then I also make suggestions for museums. So for different types of museum collections and what is available in those museum collections. So, and how those museum collections or the objects in the museum collections might be used in particular classroom situations. And then I also, the last thing I do is make some suggestions for how YouTube or other social media, and I give some examples of sources from YouTube and how those, you know, various like YouTube clips, for example, might be contextualized in relation to particular chapters from the book and how they might be used in classroom contexts.
What would you say are the key takeaways or your main argument or conclusions having done this research?
There is so much work that remains to be done. And this is, South Asian Shiism is a field that is still very much in its infancy. And I think the one thing that I realized in researching for this book is it's still very much an untapped field with tremendous potential that excites me. And there are just, I think there are so many dissertations and books that are waiting to be written.
Speaking of books waiting to be written, you mentioned this at the outset, but what are you working on now? Are you developing the same research?
So I'm working on multiple projects, but my writing project for this summer is sort of the culmination of this long-term project that I've been working on. It's a project titled Building the City of Heather, Kingship, Urban Space, and Shi'i Ritual in Qutb Shahi Hyderabad. And so this is a project that sort of has grown out of that much earlier Somatic Shiism project. And it builds out of my interest in material culture and my fascination with alams. I've written a number of articles on alams, but then when I started paying attention to the spaces that these alams inhabit and also looking more critically or analytically might be a more accurate term at the establishment of Hyderabad as a newly built city in 1591, as it was built by the fifth Qutb Shahi Sultan, Muhammad Quli, and his Peshwa Mir Momin Asrabadi, I really became very interested in how this city was laid out, which buildings were constructed first, and the types of rituals that were built, how the city was described in court chronicles and other sort of eulogistic poetry, and and other types of literature composed for other sultans, Qutbshahi sultans. And it really made me quite convinced that Hyderabad was built intentionally as a Shi'i city, which is the argument of my book.
That's fascinating. Now, before we close for today, was there anything else you wanted to mention about the book?
I think I was pretty exhaustive in describing what the book is about. I think the last thing that I would just like to say is that the other important sort of contribution that the book makes is that I think in religious studies, there's a tendency to use the word every day without really being explicit, without really theorizing what the everyday is. And this is one thing that I'm quite attentive to in this book. And so for me, the everyday has very, very clear meaning.
You have to say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So for me, you know, I think that the everyday is, you know, it's a fashionable term that gets sort of, that's used with, you know, frustrating vagueness and in imprecision. And so for me, I use it in a number of ways. You know, at the most basic level, it refers to the activities of daily life that are inflected by Shi'i religious laws, norms, ethics, rituals of belief and devotion, and gender values. So that's sort of my baseline definition. But I also, for me, and this I think is important, it's an inclusive space that recognizes both women and men as active participants in Shi'i religious life and practice without relegating women to the purview of what I see as like popular religion and men to the scholarly and intellectual domains of a danishgah, so school or university, or the hoza, mosques or libraries. And so one might consider the everyday to be a dimension of popular culture and religiosity. And I think everyday often gets glossed for the popular the lowbrow, and that's not how I see the everyday, or it falls within the domain of folklore. And I think that this tends to lead to the formation of essentializing or exclusionary binaries of popular elite and everyday scholarly that belie the on-the-ground experience of South Asian Shia. I also think that for me, the everyday resists setting up artificial binaries that posit divides between non-elite practice and the religion of the scholars. The everyday is a space that gets inhabited by all people, whether rich or poor, educated or illiterate, male or female. And I think it's also really important that it's not practiced only in the countryside. The everyday is also the domain of the urban. And so I think for me, the everyday also reveals ways in which Shi'i identities, like others, are multi-layered. They're shaped by ethnicity, caste, and socioeconomic factors, as well as by gender and age.
Thank you for speaking about your research today.
Yeah.
So for those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Karen Ruffel of the University of Toronto about her new Wiley publication, Everyday Shi'ism in South Asia. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the diversity of religion in South Asia. Take care.